Mr. Nace, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you set aside 5 minutes of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Hold just a second. That's until counsel is ready.
Sorry.
Okay.
May it please the court. Counsel, Christopher Nace on behalf of Disc Disease Solutions. Disc Disease Solutions respectfully brings this appeal because the district court erroneously imposed a heightened pleading standard at the Rule 12b6 stage. The district court erred because it failed to appreciate that the abrogation of Rule 84 and Form 18 did not overturn this court's
precedent. Let me have you address a kind of like a threshold question that I have here. In your motion to amend the judgment and also your motion for reconsideration, do I understand correctly that up until that point in time, you had not filed a second amended motion or actually even a motion to amend the complaint?
We had not filed a motion. That's correct. We had not filed a motion.
Why didn't you do that?
Well, at the time, in our responsive brief, we indicated, and albeit in a footnote,
yeah,
that if the court agreed that our pleading was inadequate, we asked for leave to amend. We did not file a separate motion. At the time,
11th Circuit law is pretty clear and consistent that a footnote contained in an opposition to a motion to dismiss doesn't serve as a valid request to amend. Posner v. Essex and Rosenberg v. Gould in the 11th Circuit stand for that express principle. How do you get by them?
Well, I think that the 11th Circuit also has a strong precedent for allowing parties that when there is a motion to dismiss or a Rule 12b6 motion where the deficiency in the pleading can be corrected by an amendment, the 11th Circuit has strong precedent that says the party ought to be able, and given that opportunity.
If you ask for it.
I don't know that.
You're not answering my question.
No, I mean to answer it in this regard. I was thinking about your exact question, about whether asking for it is the only way under the rules of civil procedure that you get the opportunity to amend. And the reason that I'm thinking that is...
No, sometimes you can amend of right if you do it early enough.
That's right. And oftentimes, in fact, scheduling orders generally have included in them deadlines by which pleadings are to be amended as well. So I don't believe that Rule 15 is the sum and substance of the entire opportunity to amend. And
it is when you get to that point, according to the 11th Circuit, you have to ask.
Does Rule 15 specify the procedure through which you have to ask? Does it say you have to file a motion?
There is a local rule in the Middle District that indicates, and I believe it's also 11th Circuit rules as case law as well, that indicates that the way to present a request to the court is through motion. We don't disagree with that. That case law is what it is. My point on the amendment, though, and again, this is what I was contemplating as I was preparing today, is that you do have Rule 15 that lays out that when you can amend as a matter of right, when you have to ask parties' consent, when you have to ask court consent. But you also have, under scheduling orders, a deadline that is often set by when you can make amendments to pleadings, in part because things come up in discovery, and the scheduling orders often permit an opportunity to amend even after certain deadlines have come and gone.
Yeah.
And the reason I raise that is because if you have a scheduling order which was suspended, which was delayed in this case on the request of the defendant appellees, that we not enter a scheduling order while the briefing was taking place, an issue that we opposed. But if you have that deadline set by the scheduling order, I think you still then have can amend as a matter of right. At that point, once the scheduling order says this is the deadline by which amendments are due.
That could be, but you never did them. You never did move to amend.
We did not move to amend.
Argument doesn't help you.
Well, we believe that even though it wasn't a footnote, and I agree with Your Honor that the case law in the 11th Circuit is that a footnote is not the appropriate way. But again, when you get into the strong preference in the 11th Circuit to have decisions, cases decided on the merits, and when you have the strong inference that if a pleading can be corrected by amendment, that plaintiffs ought to be given that opportunity. I think at that point, when you're looking at whether we asked in a footnote, whether it was by motion to reconsider, by a request to alter or amend the judgment, there's a whole host of ways to get there. Not only, by the way, the fact that the case was dismissed with prejudice. If it had been dismissed without prejudice, then we could have refiled in a pleading that
so
perhaps would have
corrected. So the analysis on that comes down to futility.
Can I ask you something? I'm a little surprised that you made that statement, because it seems to me the fact that the original decision by the district court, it wasn't clear to me whether it was with prejudice or without prejudice, and so therefore it's hard to say that your motion to amend at that point was late.
Well, we didn't know if it was clear. We agree, Your Honor. We didn't think it was clear ourselves when we read it. It didn't say.
And then the motion to dismiss, was it with prejudice or without prejudice? I thought, if I remember correctly, maybe it was the last page of the motion to dismiss said with prejudice.
But as far as the defendant appellee's pleading?
Yes.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head. I do know that one of the steps we took after the order was issued was to alter or amend for that purpose, to make it so that it was without prejudice. And it was really when we got an answer to that I think we were clear that it was with prejudice, because we had the same review. And I think the case law and the rules indicate that if a decision is, you know, it's on the merits if it's with prejudice, obviously. So we weren't quite clear in that, which was part of the reason we took some of the steps we did afterwards.
So you had those alternative pleadings that you filed.
Correct. And one of those was to try and get some clarity. I think we were hoping the court would come back and say, of course it's without prejudice, as the 11th Circuit permits. We want matters to be decided on the pleading, on the merits of the case. And yes, it's without prejudice, refile a different complaint. Of course, this all presupposes that we feel that our complaint was certainly sufficient under the case law.
I'd like to ask you about your original pleading. And in particular, I'd like to just jump quickly, just so I don't forget to ask you this, contributory infringement. I'd like to ask you a question about that, because it seems to me that you don't say much at all in that original complaint about contributory infringement. And for contributory infringement, it seems that you'd have to at least allege a fact about whether this is a non-staple article of commerce or not. And there's nothing in the original complaint. And so I'm just wondering, what is your position on that? Maybe, you know, with respect to direct infringement and induced infringement, there are some facts alleged. But with respect to contributory infringement, something that is key to a contributory infringement finding just is not even discussed.
Well, and again, that may be the case, Your Honor. I don't know that I'd put up a strong argument against that reading of the original complaint. Again, though, I think that's where you fall into the situation where we ought to have been able to amend at least one time. We weren't even given an opportunity one time. I'm not going to make a strong argument and try and read into the complaint something that's not there. So again, I think that comes down to the point, though, that we ought to have been able to amend at least one time to make the pleading, again, tighter if there was an issue on that. Let's assume that was the only issue that the district court felt was insufficient in the pleading, was uncontributory, and granted the motion to dismiss that claim. In that case, would we still have been, I think we still would be entitled to file an amended complaint to correct that claim at that point in time. Would that have been with or without prejudice? I don't know. I don't know where we would have gone with that. But I think that even at that, if that single claim had been dismissed, why wouldn't we, under the case law, be permitted to file an amended complaint that fixed that? We're here, obviously, because all the claims were dismissed.
Why was it sufficient for you to allege that that the accused device, which you identified by name and had pictures of, why wasn't it sufficient for you to say that that embodied all the elements of at least one claim? Why was it sufficient for you to say at least one claim? And why did you not have to, under Twombly, Iqbal, identify the specific claims that you were alleging?
Well,
at least one claim.
Certainly, that when you look at the case law, in specifically McZeal versus Sprint Nextel, my understanding of that in the citation is that in that case, McZeal asserted, quote, the technology cell phone product line called Motorola I-930, quote, international walkie-talkie, close quote, offered by the defendants, comma, falls within the scope of one or more claims of the patented worldwide walkie-talkie, international walkie-talkie invention, period. So falls within one or more claims. I think that type of pleading has been endorsed under the case law. So I don't know that...
That case you were citing, is that one that was decided after Form 18 was abrogated?
It was not decided after that, but then we go through a series of cases, including... So McZeal, obviously, is one, which is 501 F3rd 1354. INRI, Bill of Lading Transmission and Processing System, 681 F3rd 1323. And what I think is the most recent is K-Tech Telecoms, Inc. versus Time Warner Cable, Inc., 714 F3rd 1277. Those cases, K-Tech and Bill of Lading in particular, they all talk about the fact that Form 18, a well-pled complaint complying with Form 18 with the five factors laid out, would satisfy Twombly and Iqbal. I think that's where the trial court erred and went down an incorrect path in the regard that it looked at the abrogation of Rule 84 and Form 18 as changing the pleading requirements. And in fact, all of the case law, and remember, our complaint was filed...
The court did a Twombly-Iqbal analysis.
It did a Twombly-Iqbal analysis without regard for this court's analysis of how Twombly and Iqbal would affect pleadings without, regardless of where Form 18 came down. I mean, this court had...
I thought that our cases have really just said, look, we're not going to decide whether Form 18 satisfies Iqbal Twombly. We don't have to. We're just going to look at the complaint that's before us and see if it satisfies Iqbal Twombly. And that's what we said in Lifetime, for example.
Well, I think that the court has said, though, that you can comply with Form 18 and still satisfy Iqbal Twombly. I mean,
so you got 2 minutes left of your rebuttal time.
You don't really need to do that, though. I mean, maybe you're better off just talking about why you satisfied Bob Twombly, because you actually have more in your complaint than Form 18 does.
That's right. And again, even beyond that, let's not forget, too, that our complaint was filed before Form 18 was abrogated.
How long before was that?
It was a day before.
Oh, yeah.
But it was.
You were aware that it was coming.
Well, I think it was. Your Honor, if I could stand here and tell you that that was the date we needed to get this filed, I would. I don't know that that played any role in the filing of it. That's a candid response to you, is that I don't know that that was some strategic decision that we better get this in the day before. We filed an amended complaint with the court attached to a motion later that we certainly were capable of filing something if we felt that the case law and the requirements, what we were going to be asked to stand for, was drastically different than what had been out in the case law before. Again, there's ample cases that say, let's not get hung up on Form 18. These items that are contained in there can satisfy Iqbal Twombly. And we certainly believe that based on the precedent that our complaint did satisfy Iqbal Twombly, and beyond that, we should have been given an opportunity because the law was changing at least one time to amend.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel Megan Kent on behalf of DGH Solutions. The judgment of dismissal with prejudice in this case was a result of DDS's strategic and informed decisions, and then the District Court making a series of decisions that were supported by the rules of federal civil procedure and the precedent of the Supreme Court, the Circuit, and the 11th Circuit.
Why doesn't the original complaint satisfy Iqbal Twombly? Particularly for the 509 patent, where there's only one independent claim and there's an allegation that the accused device, which is identified by pictures, infringes at least one claim, which necessarily would have to be claim one, since that's the only independent claim.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. Iqbal and Twombly set forth that a claim has to be plausible on its face. The plaintiff has to present enough facts that a judge can draw a reasonable inference that the defendant is liable.
If the claim is identified and the accused device is identified in a picture, why isn't that enough? And then there's a statement that the thing in the picture has all the elements of the claim. Why isn't that enough?
That's not the standard for patent infringement. You don't just say, here's a picture, infringe. The standard is that each element of at least one claim is met.
Yeah, but what if the complaint, as it does in this case, says, here's the accused device, here's a picture of it. It's a inflatable back support, right?
Correct.
Here's a picture of the inflatable back support. And there's at least one claim that this inflatable back support has each and every element of the claim.
It's not enough because, to start, the 509 patent is a method patent. It's a method of manufacture. So pointing to pictures of a box of a product does not do anything to tell the judge or the defendants why those products are manufactured according to the claimed method. This court in the Lida versus CBS case laid out that to plead a direct infringement of a method claim, there have to be sufficient facts to allow the judge to reach a reasonable inference that every step of the method, of the claimed method, has been performed. They have not done that whatsoever.
So you think that requires, in direct infringement cases, it requires a claim chart?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think a claim chart could absolutely aid the court and aid the defendants in understanding what the plaintiff is claiming, whether they plead a plausible cause of action. But that could be done in the text of a complaint.
What you're saying is it requires articulation.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Is there any prejudice involved in this case?
Pardon me?
Is there any prejudice involved?
No, Your Honor.
Were your clients prejudiced, let's say, if the court had allowed the amended complaint?
At this point, Your Honor, having gone through all of that briefing.
No, I'm talking about back when all this was going on.
Sure. Well, at that point, Your Honor, we were evaluating, quite frankly, whether to prepare an IPR, and we had basis to do that. But
so had you not had the been basis told. By which to proceed in the event that a trial was forthcoming. That's not prejudice.
In evaluating,
why shouldn't the court have allowed the amendment based on the fact that it's not going to prejudice you at all?
It could have allowed it had the plaintiff requested an amendment. But the plaintiff never requested an amendment, and leave would have been freely granted had they requested.
Well, would you have opposed it on the basis of futility?
Potentially, yes. We believe, looking at the amended complaint, which is not really before this court, we would still have a basis to move to dismiss based on them being unable to prove their claims.
The concern that I have with this case is that I don't see a motion to amend. And I went back through the timeline, and I'm not sure that one was ever filed. There's arguments that the court should allow us to amend, but there never was a motion to amend, which carries your prayer for relief. And since this is what I want the court to do, this is, you know, what I think it should do. In your view of the local law, is there a requirement that an actual motion to amend be filed. Why wasn't the footnote 6 in the motion for reconsideration enough?
Right, so an argument raised in a footnote is not preserved. That's established 11th Circuit precedent and Federal Circuit precedent. 11th Circuit provides that to amend, you need to file a motion and memorandum supporting that. I do think that potentially in their opposition to amend, they could have included a more robust request for leave to amend. The 11th Circuit provides that you need to articulate in what way you would amend, and what way it would not be futile to amend. And they didn't offer the district court judge anything for her to believe that they might be able to amend and actually be able to plead a cause of action.
But isn't it common practice in that locality to allow leave for a motion to amend after a motion to dismiss has been granted?
It, I believe, would be within the district court judge's discretion to do that, but the 11th Circuit clearly states in the Wagner decision, which was an en banc decision by the 11th Circuit, that a district court judge has no requirement to sua sponte invite a plaintiff to refile.
Does the court have a requirement to provide a specific or a significant reason for the denial?
If the plaintiff had properly requested leave to amend under Rule 15A2, which they never did.
What about their motion for reconsideration? And they had two different kinds of pleadings. Following the original decision by the district court, where the district court didn't indicate whether it was with or without prejudice, and they attached to that an amended complaint. Does that operate also as a motion for leave to file an amended complaint?
No, Your Honor.
Does it have to be so styled?
No.
What is your reason for why it's not sufficient?
It was out of time to begin. Rule 15 of the federal rules provides that you may file a motion seeking leave to amend until judgment. Judgment had been entered already in this case. They had plenty of opportunities to seek to amend. At that point in time, when they were seeking reconsideration, that is determined based on 59E of the federal rules and 11th Circuit precedent that looks at whether there was a change in fact, law, or some sort of clear error.
What about how the district court said, and maybe I'm just you can help me understand the record and what happened, but the district court said in her decision, the district court judge said in the decision, said, I didn't indicate whether it was with prejudice or without prejudice, but now, yeah, I think it's with prejudice. I mean, is that what made it a final judgment, or had a judgment been entered before that fact? It was just unclear whether it was with or without prejudice.
So we did request it to be with prejudice in our motion to dismiss.
Right, but the court didn't indicate.
That's correct. The court and courts often do this, where they simply dismiss and don't indicate either way. And when they don't indicate either way, the presumption on a motion to dismiss such
is that
this,
it is without prejudice.
That it is with prejudice.
The presumption?
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the day after, actually it may have been the same day that the judge's order was entered, the clerk closed the case and entered judgment against closing the case, entered judgment.
The judgment and the motion to dismiss, or the motion to dismiss, it was granted. Those were entered the same day.
I believe so.
No time lapse between them.
I believe so, Your Honor. It was shortly thereafter. I believe it was the same day.
What is your support for the idea that the presumption, when it's not indicated, that it's with prejudice on a motion to dismiss a complaint?
I'd have to look back in our brief, Your Honor, to find the case that we cited.
When I practiced in the Ninth Circuit, the presumption was without prejudice unless you obtained with prejudice.
Our understanding was that it was presumed to be with prejudice on a motion to dismiss, 12B6 motion to dismiss.
Is that an 11th Circuit rule or holding?
I believe so, although recently in District of Delaware we ran into the same issue and it was the same presumption, Your Honor.
What reasons did the court provide to support its dismissal with prejudice?
It pointed out that the plaintiff had never requested leave to amend while it had opportunity to do so. And at the point when it was being asked to reconsider, whether it should be without prejudice or with prejudice. It was meant to evaluate whether there was new law, which there was not, new facts, which there were not, or a clear error, which there was not, because the 11th Circuit specifically states that it has no obligation.
Did the court address undue delay, bad faith, prejudice?
No, Your Honor, it did not. It was not required to do so. It would have been if it were evaluating a motion to amend under 15A2. But that motion was never brought. This, Your Honors, we believe was, DDS made strategic decisions throughout this case. It chose not to amend its complaint. It had opportunity to do so after its complaint within 21 days, after we filed our motion to dismiss, completely laying out all of the reasons why we believed their complaint was deficient. It elected not to do that. It had the strategy not to amend, even though it had named a defunct corporation. It had this aversion to amending, and it didn't. Instead, it filed its opposition to our motion to dismiss and argued in that opposition that it continued to meet the amended pleading standard. And it dropped a footnote, a half-hearted footnote, which was insufficient to request leave to amend. The district court then applied the amended rules. Form 18 had been abrogated, and it applied those because the Supreme Court's order promulgating the amended rules was that they should apply to any case then pending so long as it was just and practicable. DDS, again, made the strategic decision. It never argued that it was unjust or impracticable for the amended rules to apply to it, and it was.
So you said earlier about this presumption, you said there's something in your brief that supports that. Do you know where that's at?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I can find that.
I want to clarify something. You said that it was unjust or impractical, period, and it was, period. It looks funny in the record.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. They did not argue that it was unjust and impractical, and it was just impracticable to apply the amended rules. I'm looking, Your Honor, Judge Stoll, for the site.
What are we waiting for, a citation?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. I'm not.
So it's you think it's somewhere in your brief?
I do, and I'll.
We'll look. We'll find it.
Review, and perhaps it was not. It may not have been raised. I believe that's the rule, but perhaps it's not in here. But continuing on, the district court applied Iqbal and Twombly standard. It didn't apply Form 18 because Form 18 had been abrogated. And we had argued to the district court, and we believe it was a rational basis, that a plaintiff should have to plead sufficient facts to support a reasonable inference that every element of a claim is met. The district court didn't even go that far. It just said that a plaintiff must make some attempt to describe the alleged infringement. That's all, just some attempt. And in this case, it found that DDS had not done that. It had not gone beyond patent product infringe, which is insufficient for the district court judge to be able to reach a reasonable inference, including in particular on a method of manufacture claim.
What about the other set of claims, which are not a method of manufacture, and there's only three independent claims?
Right, so the 113 patent, Your Honor, which relates to the product, and that includes the inflatable back brace, the support structure, which goes, there's both an anterior and a posterior support structure, as well as a means of associating those two. It's a means plus function claim. It's not as simple as it appears on its face, and the simply putting a photo of a product does not provide the judge with any ability to tell whether that means of associating the structure with the inflatable belt has been met or could be met by the plaintiff in this case, and whether the plaintiff could plausibly meet meet those elements of that claim.
They don't have to prove their case, right? They just have to allege enough facts to make it plausible that there's a claim of infringement.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, but you would say that under Iqbal Twombly, whenever someone files a patent complaint and there's means plus function claims, they need to identify what the corresponding structure is and then identify where that is in the accused device?
I would think that they should make some attempts to provide the defendant and the court with a basis or to draw a reasonable inference that it could ultimately be proven. And in this case, they didn't do that.
What about the fact that we still have notice pleading? And so there's notice pleading. Do you think that in this case you had notice of what was accused of infringement and what claims were asserted?
We didn't have indication of which claims were asserted. They didn't
At least in one of them that there was one independent claim, so that would have to be the one.
Correct.
That was
and we had notice of what they were alleging, which products they were alleging, but that doesn't give us a basis to understand why they were alleging we infringed. The method of manufacture that VGH uses does not in any way practice these claims and had been explained to the plaintiff, and they had not provided in this complaint a reason for us to understand how we could possibly be infringing on this method.
Could have filed a motion for a more definite statement in the alternative.
In the alternative, we could have, Your Honor. A motion to dismiss was just equally effective.
Mm-hmm. And with prejudice, even more so.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, let's go back into the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes.
Yes. I heard counsel refer to the court applying the amended pleading standard. And, of course, that's why we're here. There is no amended pleading standard at this point. At least at the time that we filed and that this matter was briefed at the trial court, there certainly was no standard. The only standard on November 30th when we filed our complaint was the form and all the case law. And I don't want to get hung up on the form because this court had given clear pronouncement that even if you don't have the forms, if you don't worry about the forms, the fact is that the factors that are contained in the old form, if you plead those factors, that can hold up to the Iqbal Twombly standard. And that's the question here is, did our complaint satisfy Iqbal Twombly at not in a vacuum? It's not a new case on December 1, 2016. It's all the case law that had come down to that point. I cited for the court earlier the McZeal case where it specifically said that pleading that you infringe one or more claims, that was sufficient. That was sufficient at one point. What if I'm sitting here thinking, what if our complaint had been filed on November 1st or October 1st? Or how far back do you go before you say, well, you're close enough that we're gonna apply a new standard that's yet to be defined without giving you an opportunity to amend it? And I should note that in the
you had an opportunity to amend it.
Well, we had an opportunity to amend.
You didn't ask for it.
Well, respectfully, we think we did. We acknowledge now that under the case law, putting in a footnote was not sufficient. That is the case law in the 11th Circuit. But we
so
felt
you don't
that
think
we did.
I'll
acknowledge that that's under the case law in the 11th Circuit, that's not sufficient. However, that goes back, and I don't think that's necessary because if the court had dismissed the complaint without prejudice, we wouldn't need to ask leave to amend at that point. We would, if it was dismissed without prejudice, we would.
What is the practice in your circuit?
In the 11th Circuit?
Uh-huh.
Well, respectfully.
With or without?
Respectfully, I'm based here in D.C.
Oh, okay.
I am a member of the 11th Circuit, but I will tell you that I don't know that I've ever seen a situation like this where a party says, well, we'd like at least a chance to amend, and the court comes back and says, not good enough, and dismisses when the law has suddenly changed.
Well,
in
look
the
and write Miller, you'll find it.
Well, the law has suddenly, arguably changed, although we don't believe it's changed because of all the case law that had defined that a Form 18 pleading, something that aligns with that, would satisfy Iqbal Twombly.
Okay, you're out of time. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank all parties for the arguments today. The cases are now submitted for consideration. Court remains in recess.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.